Accession number 27803, Mr. Vic Stone, reel 9. Now, I think the next thing we got to was the night when the mission of the November 29th.
No,
can you tell us that, the whole story of that mission as you remember it?
As far as we were concerned, it was just an ordinary day. You know, we woke up in the morning and had breakfast as usual. We went down in one of the crew rooms, briefing rooms, and met the pilot and the bomb aimer. They were officers, you see, and they dealt in a different mess than we did. We met, had a good chat, and then later in the day they announced that Flying Officer Sloan and Finlay report to the crew rooms, together with crews, which we did. I don't know what the time would be then. It could be getting nearer midday probably then, time we sat around. And then so we went there and reported, and we were told that night there's going to be two aircraft going out on a mission to Norway, quite high up in Norway, way above the Telemark area. And they said that weather conditions permitting, we would be the two to be going. We had a brief, a short briefing then about the mission, and told to report back later. I think we went back around about half five o'clock. Weather report was good. It said there's no reason why we shouldn't go. A cloud about, but over the area it should be quite nice. Although there would be cloud there, it would be sort of intermittent, so we should be able to find the target. After that, we went back to the to our respective billets, as you call them. Emptied your pockets like you usually do. It's strange because this is the first time, I think, that we ever emptied our pockets. Well, most things out. I can remember picking up a packet of cigarettes, the Will's Gold Flake cigarettes, and a lighter, and putting those in my pocket. And then, you know, the lad said, oh, cheerio, wish you well, you know, and the usual jokes about hurry up back, we should be waiting for our beer, this sort of thing, you know. Down weather, yeah, another, it wasn't a briefing really, we just went in to see if the weather was okay. Then, yeah, they said the weather's okay, so we go out to the crew bus, they take us round to the hangar, we pick up our parachutes, Bay Wests. We'd already got all the details, the flight plan and everything from the briefing room. Normally the navigator and the bomb aimer would have all those flight plans. So had them, we came out of the hangar, having collected our equipment, get into the crew bus, and they take us round to the aircraft. They'd already loaded the aircraft, which they obviously did during the day, topped up the fuel tanks.
And do you know what the load was this time?
No, I've got no idea what the load was, no. It was ammunition. We know there's quite a bit of ammunition on board, but I don't know what else there was either. I don't know if there was anybody in the back or not, but there was certainly nobody in the front with us. So there was no, as they called it, dispatch runner. There was nobody in the front with us whatsoever. We would have seen them if there was. Anyway, so we get on the aircraft and we all take our seats, plug in the intercom, and Paddy calls, the pilot, he calls out, you know, Ron, you okay? That's by me, yes, everything all right? Your instruments okay? You're quite happy? Yes. Navigator, you quite happy? Everything? Yes. And to me, the engineer and the air gunner, the rear gunner, right, it's as if we're all happy, and he'll wave to the guy down below to move the chocks from the aircraft, and we'll start moving out. We go around the perimeter track to the end of the runway. We don't go onto the runway, we wait at the end of the perimeter track, permission to go onto the runway. Permission's given to go onto the runway. We're on the runway, the air control pilot, who's in the caravan down below, the oldest lamp, he'll give the green light, and then away we go. At the time we go off, I just have to make a log of the time that we take off, and that was it. I just sit there, just earphones on, listen to the radio. Not there's a lot on there, more or less interference. Paddy obviously opens the throttles and moves the aircraft up, takes an extra run because we're pretty well loaded this time. We had a full load of petrol, so we were going much higher and carrying a much bigger load. Going up, when I say higher, I mean higher up into Norway. Yeah, I think it was about 2,300 gallons or something of petrol. But there again, you see on takeoff, I think we burn about 8 gallons a minute on takeoff, and that's quite a lot of petrol there. Yeah, so anyway, we get off the runway, and Ron helps him get up the undercarriage. Ron being a bomb maimer, undercarriage up, all okay, all right, fellas. Right, so he says to the navigator, right, can you give me the course? Butch, give me the course to set. Butch will give him this course. He'll set the course, and he'll say, right, now we are on our way. And we just sit there and while away the time. Occasionally I just look out the Astrodome to see if, but you can see nothing at all, you know. There's just water below, so you can't see anything. After, I suppose, some, I don't know, maybe a couple of hours, I wouldn't know as for time, really. He says, I think we're about 60 mile off the coast now, the Norwegian coast now. So that was the bomb maimer navigator. And so he says, well, now, lads, he says, especially you, Bill, in the back there, he says, keep your eyes out now, he says, for anything that's around, you know, any of the enemy that's around. And he said, you know, to me and Jack, he said, just nip up in the Astrodome now and again and have a look out to see that all things are okay. Accordingly, we should be going over no heavily defended areas. We should be going over no airfields. So he said, really, we don't anticipate any trouble. But of course, you can always get picked up on radar and unexpected guests, as you may say. Eventually, Ron says, right, we're not far from the target now. He says, we're probably 5 or 6 miles from the target now. And he tells Paddy to, you know, sort of steady or left or right, whatever it is. Runs up and he said, well, now, he said, this is the pinpoint. He said, this should be the pinpoint here. right, and I get in the Astrodome and I couldn't see anything. And then suddenly I saw a light on the road at the side. But that went out very quickly. So I can only assume it was a vehicle of some sort. Anyway, we found, which we could only assume as the drop-in zone because it was the right latitude, longitude, and also the pinpoint. We went down reasonably low, I suppose 600-700 feet. Couldn't find anything, so Paddy says, right, he says, well, we'll go up and we'll go around once again to see if we get any luck. We went up, pulled up round again, made another run in. No, still couldn't see anything. Cloud was beginning to thicken, although it was it was broken. Every now and again you could see a flash of the ground. We couldn't see anything at all. And taking the time into account and the length of time we've been there, and Paddy said, well, I don't think we should risk another one. He said, what do you think? And we said, well, as disappointing as it is, with the cloud base as it was, it seemed hopeless just to go around again. We couldn't see anything. So he says, right, we'll just have to abort. So he says, right, we all agreed that we'd do abort the mission. Yes, that's fine. He says, right. So then he said to Butch, right, he said, between you and Ron, can you find me a course to set for home again? Which obviously they must have done. And we started on our way back. I don't know how far we got. I've got no idea at all in miles or even time. But suddenly we're told over the intercom, it comes over the intercom, abandoned aircraft. And Ron said, what was that? And Paddy said, I said abandoned aircraft. Oh, he said. And then he said something to Jack about the condition of the engines, and Jack's reply, it was a little bit not over clear, but something to the fact that there could be icing on one of the engines. Paddy then said again, well, abandoned aircraft. So with that, I put my parachute on. I already had my harness on, midway west. Put me parachute on. Jack was at his controls there. I got up, walked past the navigator who sits on the left, and the flight engineer has got a little seat on the right hand side there, a little movable seat, so that if, like this, in a case of emergency, he can move the seat out of the way and we can get through. As I got level with Butch, Ron had opened the hatch down below, and he was, there's a couple of steps up to the main cabin, and he was there saying to Paddy cheerio or something. I couldn't hear what he was saying. And then he turned around, went down and went out the hatch. I went past Butch and I tapped Teddy on the shoulder and said cheerio, and he said cheerio, and I went out. After that, I don't know who went next. There was some discrepancy about who went next, but I don't know who it was because I'd already gone. The parachute opened within a couple of seconds, it must have been. And as I looked down, all I could see was a whole mess of grey, which I thought was the sea. I pulled out the tube for the May West and started to blow it up. But as I started to blow it up, so I broke cloud, and I could see the forest trees, which I was almost into then. Anyway, I hit in the trees, came down a certain distance within the trees. The parachute started to cling on to the side of these trees, and eventually it did hold me. It stopped me, and I was swinging there, I don't know, probably 10, 15 feet from the ground, I think I must have been. At that time, it was cloudless at that time. It was really nice. I could see down below, beautiful white, everything looked lovely. Anyway, I undone the harness, dropped out of the harness, pulled the straps as hard as I could, managed to get some of the parachute down, but couldn't get it all down. In the boots, we had a little knife in the side of the boots, in between the fur and the outer boot, and that was if we needed it, which we did, which I needed it then, because some of these panels of parachute I was cutting off in pieces, but cut them off and put them inside my battle. They called it battle dress. That was what it is. We used to, yeah. Tucked it in there. Got a considerable amount in there. And
that's,
I thought,
to keep you warm.
Yes.
Did you hurt? I mean, that's 10, 50. You had quite a drop when you released yourself. Did you hurt yourself? Or?
No, not really. I've an idea that when I came out, I think one of the under straps on the parachute, you have two over and two come up, and I have an idea one of those wasn't on properly, but I felt quite a bit of discomfort, but it wasn't due to the drop, I don't think. But I can remember just standing there thinking, I don't know, middle of the night in Norway on my own, I don't know where I am, what do I do now? I can remember just thinking that as plain as anything. I thought, well, it's no good walking up the mountain. The best thing is to walk down the mountain. So I headed down. Bear in mind, it was snow. It must have been a foot thick, probably more than that. Very difficult to walk. Very difficult. But, you know, you sort of trudge down. Eventually, I came to, it was only a track. We would call it like a farm track, which goes up to any farms here if you go out in the country. But there, of course, it was a road, because the roads in the mountains were only like that. They didn't have proper roads there at all. I came down to this road and decided which way to turn. Eventually, I thought, well, if in doubt, to turn right, you can't be wrong. So I turned right. I walked a distance. I've got no idea how far, no idea at all. And I came to another track leading off this one, quite a wide one. It's probably used as one of their roads. It was on the right, so I thought, well, I'll have a walk up here. I started to walk up there. I hadn't got over far, I suppose. Well, I don't know, quarter of a mile, if that. And I could see a house in front of me, or a building. So it was a building, a lodge, it could have been anywhere. I saw this building. And as I was walking, I saw something go to, like, across the front of it, something yellowish. and I thought it was a husky dog. And of course I stopped and just looked, and then I saw it move again. And I thought, well, I don't know, that's certainly not a dog. So as I walked a bit nearer, this what I thought came towards me, and eventually it was the bomb aimer. And of course we saw each other, give each other a little cuddle, and very, very pleased, you know, that we'd seen somebody. So we said, well, we're going to knock at this house and see.
What was his name again? Just a
Ron. And so we thought, well, we knock on the door of this house, which we did. A very, very slight chink in the curtain, very, very slight. It's only because we were close to it, you could see it. Anyway, we knocked on the door and nothing happened. We knocked again, still nothing happened. So we thought, well, we'll open the door. And we opened the door, which assumed that that was the front door. We opened the front door, and to the right was another door, which we opened and looked in, and there was quite a large table in there. There was a man and a man and a lady. I'm sure it could have been an adult, really, but we took it as a man and a lady and two children. But it could have been, on second thoughts, you know, we didn't stay there long. We said to them, Englanders, and they didn't say anything. We just said, Englanders again, and they never said anything. So we said, well, look, I think the best thing we can do is to turn and go out, because if the Germans find out we're here, these people could be in trouble. So we turned round and went out, stood outside the front door debating which way to go, decided we would turn right again, so we went up. We probably walked, 200-300 yards, and it was, we came to some water, and I say water, it was a lake or something there, and there was these flat-bottom boats there, but they had water in them or ice in them. So we said, well, no, this is not the way for us, we can't go this way. So we turned round and started walking back again. Can't remember seeing any other houses. Can't remember seeing any other houses at all. I think if we had have seen other houses, we may have knocked on them. But walked down to the road, which I originally came up, then decided which way to go. So this time we decided we go to the left. So we went to the left, which is the way that I'd come, actually. And we walked along. We found at the side of the road a little hut which they used to keep logs of wood in. These were for the burners on the backs of these trailers. They used to burn these logs to create fuel for the German staff cars and the cars. I don't know how they did it, but apparently by burning wood you can transfer it into a gas, and that's what they used. And they had a trailer on the back and a great big, like a barrage balloon, and they used to stop every so often, I suppose, pick up these logs, put them in their little fires on the back on a trailer, and whatever it was, they had their own way of using this. Anyway, we did manage to clamber into this after a while, and we thought we'd stay there, but it was so bitterly cold, we thought, well, no, it's best if we move on. Because, I mean, we were quite fit. We left home a few hours beforehand, and we'd had plenty to eat, and we were fit. I mean, in the service, we had all the food we wanted. I think about twice or three times we did this at different ones along the road. I don't know if it was one day or 2 days or even into the third day. I really can't remember, but it could have been late afternoon, because it gets dark quite early there. It could have been late afternoon, it could have been early evening, it could have been during the night, I don't know. But we're walking along this road, and we heard engines, lorry engines, you know, motor engines. We looked down the side, it was quite a steep slope down the side, and we thought, well, it's a sort of jump over there, it's not the thing to do. You jump over, you don't know if you're going to roll down into the snow. And so we stood on the edge of the road, and they just came up. There was about two or three lorries, slightly on a bend of a road, and we could see two lorries. Whether there was another one round the bend or not, we don't know. But there was a staff car that came up, and these lads, I suppose they're only your 17, 18, and there's quite a lot of them, about 14, 15, maybe more. And all pointing their rifles, you know, sort of halt, and so we just stood there, and the German staff car had about three officers, I think it was, two or three officers. Anyway, they got out and they came over and spoke to us. We didn't understand them and they didn't understand us. But they intimated that we should get into the car, which we did. And we got into the car and they drove off. After driving a short while, Ron said to me, look in the front there. Look in the mirror. So I said, what do you mean, look in the mirror? He said, look in the driving mirror. Looked in the driver. He said, do you recognise that fellow? And I looked and I said, no. He said, I'm sure that was the fellow who was in the house where we'd been to. So I said, I don't know about that, because this man, he had a peaked cap on this time, not a chauffeur's cap. Whereas normally in the house, we saw him just ordinary with no jacket on or no cap on. So anyway, we're driving along, and then they started talking about they started talking about the boats that they'd sunk, about the hood and this and that, and they sort of laughing and jeering, and of course we said Tirpitz, and that really upset them though, because it's only about 15 or 16 days before that the Tirpitz had been sunk by the Air Force in the fjord there. And I got really annoyed about that. I put my hand in my top pocket to get some cigarettes out, and I felt a gun in my side. So I took it out again, and the fellow this side just looked at me, and he put his hand in, and oh, gold flake, gold, good, they're good cigarette, and good cigarette is a gold flake. So very generously, he offered them round. I had one. Ron didn't smoke, so he didn't have one. And we sat there having a smoke. Eventually pulled up at, as I say, I got no idea where. I can remember we got out, we were hustled out of this car. A few steps, not very many, and hustled into a building, into a room, and then through this room into another large room. In there, in the centre of the room, was quite a large table, very large table. Quite a few in there, four or five Germans in there. I suppose they were just working there. I've got no idea if it was offices, if it was... I wouldn't like to say what it was. It could have been anything at all. They told us to sit down, which we did. Tried asking us questions, but we didn't know. After about an hour, they said about food, and we said no, we didn't fancy anything. Again, they bought about coffee, and we said yes. Well, they bought in some coffee, which was ersatz coffee, which was made, I think, from shrubs or something, but we didn't fancy it, so we said no. There was a couple of bunks in there, and we got on the bunks in the morning. Some more officers came in. Kept asking us a whole lot of questions. We said no, we just give you our name, rank and number, that's all we have to do. They weren't very happy about this, but there's nothing they could really do. They said, well, they're going to send, they said they're going to send for the Gestapo. I'm sure they said they're going to send for the Gestapo. So we just bided our time. Ron had a scarf with him, which it was a large panel of silk, which his lady friend had embroidered lots of names on it, because we'd only just gone back off leave, and on this scarf she'd embroidered all the names, like the girls in the cookhouse and different names. And they had this on the table with pieces of paper, and we had the idea, and they were thinking it was a code of some sort, and they were trying to decipher it, and of course they kept asking us, and we said no, it's not, it's nothing at all. But they didn't believe us. Once again, they got very irate. They get very irate very, very quickly, start waving their hands and shouting. And anyway,
now before we go on, because obviously we get further into when you're captured, what had happened in the aeroplane? what had happened to the aeroplane and what was going on with Paddy? Did you ever find out?
No. It is such a mystery, this. See, I mean...
Did it crash? I mean...
No, he got back home. He got back home, and the gunner, the rear gunner. You see, if you want me to, do you want me to tell you about that now?
When would it fit in best for the story?
I don't know. You see, the only way I can think it would fit in better is when we came home and we met Paddy and Bill. You follow, after the prisoner of war, after the war. If you want to know.
No, we'll do it then.
Yeah?
I think we'll do it then.
And you see, when we bailed out, we had no idea. We had no idea what happened to him. We had no idea whether he crashed. No idea at all. We could only assume that he crashed.
Well, we'll leave it at that for then. So that's you thought then. Thought you were the two survivors.
Four survivors.
Where are the other two? Where are they gone?
Butch.
Had you met them yet?
No.
Just you and the bomb aimer at the moment.
As far as I know, we were just two survivors. I mean, we could only assume that as the others were told to jump, they jumped. But we had no idea, definitely. No.
Right.
Not until, you see, as time went on, and then...
I didn't mean to interrupt you, because you're telling a very good story here. So you're having these preliminary interrogations. They're getting very irate because they can't get anything out of you about this scarf.
That's right. Anyway, I don't know whether it was the following day or the day after, they said we're going to be moved, and they took us out. Time of day, I don't know, because bear in mind, you know, you've got no idea the time. You wake up in the morning and you're just there. They took us out, I think it was about four or six of them marched us down from this hut to, which was a railway station, but not as we know it. It was like an American boardwalk, you know. And they marched us down there. We waited there for the train. The train came along. We got on board. There was about four other guards with them, I'm not sure, put us into a carriage. It was a corridor train, I know that. They put us into a carriage. One guard sat to my right. I sat next to him, Ron sat next to me. There was a guard on the left of Ron, and there was two sat across the other side. We were waiting in the station, or whatever it was, in the siding, wherever it was, for the train to pull out. And the door was open. A man came along. He had two girls, I suppose. I don't know what age they could be. Probably 10, 12, 14, I don't know. It would be two girls, well wrapped up they were. And they looked in, and then he came back and he said, good luck, English boys. The Germans were very annoyed about this. One of them got up and went out in the corridor and shouted at him and said something. Came back, pulled the door across, pulled the blinds down. And that was it. From there, I don't really know where we went. At the time, I thought they took us to Kristiansand. But if they did take us to Kristiansand, they took us a hell of a long way round. But all I can think is that they did take us to Kristiansand. They took us somewhere and put us onto a boat, and we went across from wherever it was. It could have been Kristiansand, it could have been Oslo. We went from here to Frederikshavn in Denmark. We was right in the hold of the boat, right at the very, very bottom of the boat. And then from there, we went... we went to...